to welcome as our guest Professor William Alex Pridemore, who has very graciously made the trip from Indiana to be with us today. He is a professor in the Department of Criminal Justice and the Director of Graduate Studies at Indiana University in Bloomington. He is also an affiliate faculty member of the Russian and East European Institute at IU. He's also Associate Director of the Consortium for Education and Social Science Research and Director of its Workshop on Methods, which he tells me is one of the fun parts of his job. Received his PhD from SUNY Albany. Is a member of a number of national consortia that study the violence and that study the geographic part of the world in which we are all interested. In 2008, Dr. Pridemore received the Junior Scholar Award from the American Sociological Association's section on alcohol, drugs, and tobacco. As we'll hear this morning, his main research interest is in the impact of social structure, economic transition, and alcohol consumption on homicide and suicide in Russia. His work has been funded by every institute you could imagine, from the NIH, from the National Council on Eurasian and East European Research, from the National Institute of Justice, National Science Foundation. He's published in all of the leading criminology journals, and also quite a few of the important public health and Eurasian studies journals as well. And so it is a pleasure to welcome you here. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks, Judy. I'm going to stand up because and unfortunately, I'm putting in about 70 hours a week on purely administrative things and don't get to deal with my research as much anymore as I would like to. So I have everything put together, but I haven't actually been through and practiced this talk. So luckily, it's on some work that we've already done, but hopefully maybe you haven't read it yet, so it'll be something that's new to you. But I need the slides to prompt me. So thanks to Judy for hosting and for the nice introduction. Thanks, obviously, to CSIS for the invitation and all of you folks for coming out this morning. I saw that we have about 90 minutes for total, so I have about 45 minutes worth of presentation material, and hopefully that'll be okay, and we'll have plenty of time for questions and answers after that. I'm going to do a few things this morning. First, I'm going to talk just very briefly some very simplistic things that probably most people in the room know about in terms of the mortality crisis, but I'm doing that just to set the context for the specific things that I'll discuss. Then I'll provide a little bit of a background on the large-scale population-based case control study that from which all the data and the analyses that I'll be talking about throughout the rest of the discussion come from. And then I'll talk about three specific studies that are either published, two of them are published, and one is forthcoming to address some of these major issues. So just a little bit of information first about the, as I said, simplistic information. Most folks probably know this, but this just shows a life expectancy at birth from 1980 to the late 1990s, and I have a figure later that takes this these time series out a little more. The line there is the end of the Soviet Union at the end of 1991. And you see, obviously, a tremendous drop of about 10% in life expectancy, and it had already gone down a little bit between 1991 and then when it was at its nadir, I guess, in 1994, down to about 57 and a half years. The gap between male and female is one of the largest and industrialized nations in the world, and obviously for industrialized nations, the life expectancy for males is one of the lowest in the world. But as folks probably know as well, this was not felt, the effects of the transition on mortality were not felt equally throughout the population. First of all, as we know, as we just showed there, males had a much more have much more of an effect on males than females. Interestingly enough, it had a much more serious impact on the working age population. What's interesting here is that, or why this is interesting or relatively unique, is that in times of crises, when it comes to mortality, usually you see those that are most vulnerable are the young, very young, and especially the very old in terms of morbidity and especially mortality. But what we saw in Russia was quite unique, is you didn't see that, where you saw the biggest drops or the biggest increases, I guess, in mortality were among what we're calling working age males, those 25 to 54. And then also as well, it wasn't felt equally in terms of socioeconomic status. I'm going to show a paper a little bit later that we have forthcoming that talks about this, but there was a significant differential impact for the poor relative to the middle and upper classes. And then finally, less with about people and more about causes of death, where this mortality is coming from, excuse me, is that it's not just as if causes of death kind of rose equally across all different causes that were leading to this crisis, but instead the largest increases in causes of death came from cardiovascular mortality, IHD, ischemic heart disease, and from external causes. I look mostly at violence, homicide, and suicide, but also alcohol-related causes, those causes of death that are due directly to alcohol. And given my interest in homicide and suicide rates, I'll throw this slide up there, especially since it contains three of the major causes I just talked about. It doesn't have heart disease on here, but it has homicide, suicide, and alcohol-related mortality. These data go all the way back to 1956. These data were actually, as most of you probably know, state secret until several years ago. What was interesting, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, it's just peripheral, but what was interesting is that all the data were there. There seemed to be no pressure to falsify data on the death certificate during the Soviet period for things like homicide and suicide. Why do you need to falsify them if you're just going to lie about them anyway? So to the public. And so what occurs, there was an actual table, the secret table 5B, in which homicide deaths, suicide deaths, and some other things that were kind of embarrassing to the state were kept in. And so a colleague of mine, a demographer Vladimir Shkolnikov, and a group of his colleagues were able to go back, get the underlying data from the secret table, reclassify them into where they should be. And so we have this long time series now. And even now, they've gone back even further than 56. But at any rate, you see this relatively long time series. You see the drop in these age-adjusted deaths per 100,000 for homicide, suicide, and alcohol-related deaths in the mid-80s, which is associated with the anti-alcohol campaign, and then the really tremendous increases, sharp increases, following the collapse of the Soviet Union. So following the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a recognition relatively early on especially among demographers, Anatoly Vyshinsky, who trained Vladimir Shkolnikov and Shkolnikov himself about the crisis that was occurring. The initial studies soon revealed that while other factors were certainly playing a role, and we'll talk about some other factors besides alcohol, although when you talk about Russia and health, it's hard to get beyond alcohol. But at any rate, although there were some other important causes, the alcohol was emerging as playing a very serious role in this mortality, in the mortality crisis. And it was found to be implicated in a wide range of types of death. I've looked at, using both cross-sectional and time series data, and now some individual level data, looked at the association between alcohol and homicide in the country, and alcohol and suicide in the country. And there was, as some of you again probably may know, there was some controversy for a little while surrounding the role of alcohol and sudden cardiovascular mortality in Russia. There's still a little bit of argument back and forth, but that there seems to be a growing consensus that given what and how Russians drink, it does have an impact on sudden cardiovascular mortality. So alcohol has been shown to play a role in these major leading causes of death, the ones that were influencing the mortality crisis that I just talked about. So one of the issues here, however, is that the studies that I just mentioned, including mine, we're all from routine data at the structural level, so using population-level data. I'm a sociologist and criminologist, and I test sociological theories, and so to me this is no problem because we're testing structural-level theories, so we go out and look at what the structural-level data say. For epidemiologists and demographers and some other folks, however, it's important to see when you do that, though, you don't, for any quantitative folks in here, you only have the marginals, right? You don't have information when you have the population level data. You don't have information about the individual level deaths themselves, so you don't know if any particular death in this case, or when I look at violence or whatever, actually had alcohol involved in it. So not a lot of individual level data existed. Those the individual level that did exist. Another problem with epidemiology, I do some work in this as well, is that you don't have controls. You have the people that present, if you're looking at morbidity, they present to the doctor, to the hospital, whatever it may be, the emergency room. Or in this case, we're looking at decedents. But that's only the information. That's all the information you have is about the people that show up. You don't have information about control, so you don't have a baseline. So you're unable to determine if, in this case, individual drinking or other types of behavior was playing a direct role in mortality. And so this particular study was conceived to take a look at individual level issues as they relate to the mortality crisis. And this is called the Ajesque Family Study. It was supported by the Wellcome Trust, and there's ongoing support for that. My initial work with these folks comes from NIH, actually on a different study initially, but it was looking at alcohol and death more generally. Excuse me. The main principal investigators on this are Dave Leon, who's an epidemiologist, Martin McKee, who's medically trained but does mostly public health stuff now, although among the wide range of things that they were doing in this particular study, Martin was basically, or having folks there on the ground, cutting out the hearts of the decedents to do heart assays. So it's a really broad-ranging study that we have going on here. And Vladimir Shkolnikov was also a PI on the project. He's a Russian demographer who about a decade ago now, maybe a little less, moved to Germany with the Max Planck Institute for Demographic Research. The general aim of the study was to investigate the causes of mortality among working-age Russian males in a typical Russian city, Ijesk, which is in the Udmurt Republic, a typical kind of industrial Russian city about 1,000 kilometers east of Moscow on the western Urals. There were some specific alcohol-related goals here to assess. First of all, alcohol as an independent variable. Is it affecting the mortality crisis, and if so, how at the individual level? But also, as a dependent variable, what social, economic, and demographic factors are associated with hazardous alcohol consumption? Okay, a little bit more here. So this was a case-control design. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the methods part. That can be pretty boring. I think this, except for methods folks like me, it's pretty boring for everyone else, so I won't get into that. But this design is very important. A case-control design, we have all the cases were decedent males between 25 and 54 for whom at least one proxy interview could be done. These were decedent males who died between October 2003 and September 2005. So what was done was, I wasn't a part of the project at this time, so I don't mind praising what they've done, so I'm not praising myself. They did a really fantastic job with this. Essentially what happened was when the males showed up at the morgue, at the hospital, whatever the case may be, if they were able to find at least one family member to do a proxy interview, that decedent became a case. The proxy interviews... it went down a list, right? So first of all, your first choice is a spouse. If you can't get a spouse, you try to get someone else who lived with the person in the same home. If you can't do that, you get a mother or father, something like that. And they interviewed, they did this proxy interview about mostly about the last year of the decedent's life. And it was very comprehensive, not only looking at these alcohol issues that I talked about, and I'll come back to that in a minute, but diet, general health during that last year, their work, employment history, marriage history, all different sorts of things that they took a look at during the last year. And then there were a few things that they looked at lifetime prevalence. So their employment history, had they ever been incarcerated, these sorts of things. So did a really, really great job with that. The controls were living males that were matched by age and chosen from a population register, which, and this ended up with 1,750 cases, 1,750 controls. We'll talk a little bit about the information on alcohol consumption here, since this is a frequent topic, and I'll talk about it with a couple of different specific studies. We had they collected the usual information on quantity frequency. For epidemiologists who study alcohol, usually the questions you ask are how much of what types as well, and how often. So you'll get a quantity frequency scale per week or per month or something like that. It's important, however, to take into context what and how Russians drink, which is a little bit different quite a bit different sometimes, actually, than in other places in the world. So this was a place where they used some, what I think are some really interesting methodological innovations. And I really think that's the case because I'm a member of an alcohol epidemiology group, and that's what I was in Australia for, was to give a presentation there, and we have this meeting every year. And they always talk about the quantity frequency measures and assume that that fits everywhere no matter where you go, but don't take into account cultural context. And one of the things that they did on this particular study was to look at a couple of behavioral measures that might be somewhat specific to Russia. So one is they asked about during the last year had the decedent had, and I don't know what to say in English, but zapoy. Right, you go off on two or three or maybe more days of drinking, heavy drinking, and basically essentially lose touch with society and many other things, maybe your own family, et cetera. And what's that?
Binge drinking?
Yeah, a bender, right? So we have to be careful with binge because it has a couple of different meanings with the alcohol folks. But if we say a binge, yeah, so you're off on a bender. I remember reading like Tolstoy always had a, mm-hmm. and some other folks had a phrase, and I forget the phrase that they used. It'll pop back into my head later. Oh, a spree was what it was always how it was kind of translated when I read this in some Russian novels. But at any rate, but so we know what zapoy is. So it's a very serious drinking binge. They looked also at the consumption of surrogates, non-beverage alcohol. So these are ethanol-containing substances, but that are not sold for consumption, right? So medicines and tinctures, aftershaves, cleaning fluid, lighter fluid, anything with ethanol in it, alas. And these are often consumed enough to matter. And I'll show you what some of the outcomes of that are. A little later, but also some other behavioral measures which are kind of interesting and it might be applied in other places. So they asked about the frequency of hangovers, so once a week or more or whatever. How often did the person fall asleep with their clothes on as a result of being drunk? When I think about when I was in college and how often this, I heard about that this happened anyway among my friends. But then another one was how often, again, per week or per month or whatever, were they unable to perform their family or work duties as a result of drinking? So these are some behavioral measures that were, I think, pretty innovative. I spent too much time on that, I think. So
excuse
I should
me,
before.
Just,
yeah, sure.
Ask questions about her mental state, depression.
Very general. These weren't psychologists that were doing the study, so I think they're very general questions, but there were questions about along those lines, yeah.
And change of that from some kind of baseline, are you really becoming more depressed?
They don't do. What you're doing essentially when they do this particular survey is, for the most part, a one-year prevalence. And it's a pretty long survey already that they're doing with these proxies. So you'll have a couple of questions that are kind of general types of mental health, emotional health questions, but not over that particular time frame. So from beginning to end or whatever, during the last time year prevalence as opposed to. Okay, so some findings thus far, and these are specific studies that I'm going to talk about. The impact of alcohol and premature mortality, then I'll tell you how important that is, and then I'll say, well, okay, that's important, but we've got to look at some other things. and that is socioeconomic differentials. And then I'll talk about something that's kind of unique and most people haven't, or very few people have discussed thus far, and that is homelessness in the country. This first study, I'm not even an author on, but I want to tell you about it because it came out of this particular study, it came out of the larger Ijevsk family study, and it's a very important one. It's got a lot of attention. It upsets some people at the very, very top, as high as we go in Russia. But it has garnered considerable attention in the last couple of years since it was published about a year and a half or 2.5 years ago. Now, let me get my place here. Okay, so I'm just going to show you a couple of tables, first of all. And the first thing that I want to do, you know, don't worry about the numbers. If you're in the back, the numbers don't really matter. I'll tell you the things that matter the most. But we see these are essentially two different tables. Here, the top, this is the association of mortality from all causes with frequency of non-beverage alcohol drinking. I should have put that second because that's at the bottom. And then the mean volume of ethanol consumed from the beverages, from alcoholic beverages. So first off, one of the things that we can see, or I'll tell you about if you can't see here, is that these usual quantity frequency measures are not telling us much. It makes it look like alcohol doesn't really have that much of an effect. What's going on here, since you probably can't read this, is that the reference category are people that drink, but they drink less than a half a bottle or equivalent of vodka per week. And then the different categories are 0.5 to 1 bottle, 1 to 2 bottles, 2 to 4. And there are actually no differences in premature mortality on drinking until you get to the highest level. And that's at least 4 bottles or the equivalent of vodka per week. And when you get to that level, there those people that drink that much relative to people that drink less than a half a bottle a week were 3 times more likely to die. So there is an effect, but you got to get pretty high, 4 bottles a week or more of vodka, right, before this effect shows up using the quantity frequency scales. On the other hand, at the bottom, we see something different. This right now is just the non-beverage alcohols, the surrogate alcohols that I mentioned earlier. The reference group at the bottom are those folks that either never or almost never, essentially never really drink these types of alcohols. And then those folks that only drink them 1 to 3 times per month or less are about 3 times more likely to die. These are all males, by the way. We're going to have this 25 to 54-year-old males. People that drink them at least once or twice a week are 5 times more likely to die. People that drink them 3 to 4 times per week, we're just going to go up. It's going to get really high, right? And those folks that, this is a relatively small number, but not as small, almost 10%. So it's not as small as one might think, who drink this stuff daily, were more than 20 times more likely to die prematurely. So one would think, 120 out of 1,300, so about 9% or so folks among the cases were drinking these surrogate alcohols daily. This looks at both type of alcohol, that is beverage. Oh, this is even worse. Ooh, it's bigger, but you can't read it. I don't know what happened there. But anyway, I'll tell you what these things say. So this is by type of alcohol, beverage and non-beverage, but also by pattern. And so the problem drinking here is defined as at least once per week of those behavioral things that I talked about. Not once a week, that boy, but once a week, did you go to sleep with your clothes on because you were drunk? Did you have a hangover at least once a week? These sorts of things. So any one of those three at least once per week. The reference category here is people that drink alcohol, but they're not classified as having a problem. The people that drink alcohol and are classified as having a problem, based upon that definition, were 3 times more likely to die. Males were 3 times more likely to die prematurely. People that weren't classified or defined as having a drinking problem, but based upon that definition I told you, but they drink these non-beverage alcohols, were 6 times more likely to die. And the folks that that had a drinking problem based on that definition and drank the surrogate alcohols were about 10 times more likely to die prematurely. So a little bit of discussion with this particular case, or this particular study. 51% of cases relative to 15% of controls are classified as problem drinkers, or they drank these non-beverage alcohols. So essentially, these are all the decedent males. Of those decedent males, 50% of them were either drank non-beverage alcohol or were problem drinkers. I didn't put this odds ratio up there from earlier, but just those who were problem drinkers were six times more likely to die. Those people who drank non-beverage alcohol, just yes or no, did they drink non-beverage alcohol, yes or no, dichotomous, within the last year, those folks were 7 times more likely to die. And this is the figure that was really stunning and that got the most attention and that upset some people all the way to the top. And now the folks on the ground in Izhevsk, the local Izhevsk folks that are part of the study, have been harassed quite a bit, and probably going to move out of Izhevsk and go elsewhere for this. But at any rate, kind of the conclusion here, nearly half, over 40% of the premature mortality in this sample was due to hazardous drinking. And there's no reason to believe that Izhevsk is much different than anywhere in the country. The mortality patterns are in Izhevsk are about the same as elsewhere. The overall mortality rate, the life expectancy is pretty much the same as elsewhere, or the overall Russian mean, these sorts of things. And if generalized to all of Russia, this would translate to 170,000 excess deaths per year due to hazardous drinking. So in the early 2000s, there were about right around 400,000 or so excess deaths per year, premature mortality, and hazardous drinking looked to be the cause of almost half of those.
Sorry, question.
Yeah, sure.
What would that 170,000 represent as a percentage of the active male labor force? You're looking at the labor force. What percentage of the labor force is
that? I don't know that. I could look that up pretty easily, but I don't know that off the top of my head.
That must be a scary picture.
It is, right? It's scary in terms of looking at the mortality among this group generally, and then it's scary when you see, for example, you think, well, how many people are drinking, you know, surrogate alcohols daily or even frequently or whatever, and see the impact that this has, and it's much higher than you would normally expect. But think of all the other. We're just talking about mortality, right? So you talk about the labor issue, so production, and everything else that goes along with health or poor health in a person's life, the impact that has. This is only the kind of tip of the iceberg. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sort of struggling with the data in the sense of correlating your hazardous drinking with actually health issues that you don't really measure. You're looking at some behaviors, but they're not really related to health. Whether somebody falls asleep at night in their pajamas, or whether they have problems with their family, aren't really health-related behaviors. They may be behaviors that are sociological issues,
right.
So that translating that to a health outcome by saying that you have mortality related to high drinking based on a socially is sort of difficult for me, particularly when you're tying it to alcohol, and the real mortality here is related to the non-alcohol beverage drinking, and that's not beverage alcohol, that's ethanol alcohol.
Right.
And so then you have a different kind of alcohol. I mean, you look at these things and they're not made for you know, consumption.
Right.
So that I don't, you know, the message for me is that you shouldn't drink, you know, the things that you're not supposed to drink.
Right.
Because if you get drink, what was it, 4 bottles of 700 mils of vodka per week, and you're only going to see the data jumping out at me on vodka consumption, but on hazardous ethanol consumption. Well, you have, really shouldn't drink anyway.
There are a couple of, well, there are several issues in there. I'll try to pick a couple out, and then we'll go into the next topic, and then we can come back and talk about this if you want. One is that those behavioral measures aren't meant to measure anything about health. They're meant to measure something about, they're meant to be alternative measures of alcohol consumption. And the reason that's the case is because even when, you know, when you measure something like alcohol consumption and you ask, first of all, if you ask anyone, especially Russians in general who aren't used at that particular time and even now to these sorts of social science surveys and are very wary of people asking them all sorts of questions and asking all sorts of questions about alcohol, you're not going to get a very good point estimate from how much one drinks. And especially with asking a proxy, you're not even asking the person, you're asking someone else about that, right? So just because that says 0.5 liters or half a bottle or less of vodka per week or 1 to 2 bottles of vodka, there is likely to be considerable systematic measurement error in there, measurement error that's not random, and we know what happens when that occurs. So you look for alternative ways to get at that particular issue. Is might there be other ways to measure this that that get beyond a quantity frequency measure that may be more specific?
Yeah, but you don't look at any DSM-4 measures. You don't look at abuse. You don't look at, you know, when I think of hazardous alcohol consumption, I think of, you know, more the NIAAA definition where you're looking at you know, there's lots of different ways, but it's hazardous to your health as opposed to, I mean, it's hazardous. You take a drink, you can't drive a car, but it's not hazardous to your health unless you get into a crash.
So it's not hazardous? Drinking that much is not hazardous to your health?
If you take a drink and you get into a car, any one of us get into a car, it's hazardous drinking because you're setting yourself up in a hazardous situation, but it's not really hazardous to your health until you get into the accident.
So alcohol consumption doesn't have any other hazardous effects on one's health,
no,
especially
I'm,
at this level.
I'm saying that when there are different ways in which you can interpret the word hazardous, and if you come from a health perspective,
right,
that's really, and you're looking at something from the NIAAA, then you're looking more at a health perspective rather than a more sociological perspective. You know, you're looking at, do they meet DSM-4 criteria of abuse or dependence, as opposed to whether you're actually doing something that you shouldn't be doing, either drinking bad alcohol. I mean, you could go in there and you could also, I don't know if the group measured, you know, homebrew. I mean, is that part of the...
Yeah, sure. Okay. I'm presenting a very small amount here. This is our study. And we can, as I said, we can talk about this at the end. But I think there are some very important issues to address right there. And here is one. I strongly disagree that something is hazardous to your health. You are defining out some very serious issues when something is hazardous only due to a car or something like that, you know, driving after consumption. As we'll see in a minute, as most of us know, there are all sorts of other ways that alcohol has very serious detrimental effects on one's health, not just sociologically, but on one's health. Alcoholic cardiomyopathy, obviously alcohol liver disease. In Russia, alcohol poisoning, which is a tremendous issue. So to say that those things are not health related as a result of alcohol, I think you're defining out a large portion of health issues. Not that these other things don't matter, but I mean I don't know what to say.
I'm saying that if you're going to talk about alcohol poisoning, so probably you're more than likely someone's going to die from alcohol poisoning. And noticing that there's a large number of psychiatrists, most in Europe, that you have a large, narcology health component in there that deals with the alcohol issue.
So one could look at that. One could look at emotional health and mental health as it relates to these things. We are looking at physical morbidity and mortality. Because one does a study on one thing doesn't mean that, in this case, mortality, that we say, well, therefore, you know, mental health or emotional health or depression or something not only doesn't have an effect, but it doesn't matter. So I'm sympathetic, but you know, can't do everything in one study if you'd like to.
And I don't know if you're going to talk about this, but isn't it the case that also out of these data have been a couple of publications that have talked about things like miscoding of causes of death that fundamentally involved alcohol poisoning, for example, so that a lot of this data has been mined for precisely the kinds of things you're talking about.
Show those measurement issues.
Dr. Frinmore, I think you reflected in analysis of the previous paper, or maybe for me it felt like reflection. The definition of alcohol in different cultures, it might be a different definition. What is alcohol? And you said, well, they shouldn't be drinking non-beverage alcohol drinks. For them, it is alcohol. In Russia, the cologne is another form of a drink. And in our society, it is something to perfume yourself with. In Russia, it's another way of, it's another alcoholic beverage. In some cultures, beer is not considered to be an alcoholic drink, but rather a refresher. In our society, beer is, it's why I think,
it's a great point. The cultural context.
Cultural definition, what is alcoholic beverage? And it's really great that you drew the line between official beverage of alcohol and non-official beverage.
It's fascinating, and this is something, as I said, a lot of the alcohol epidemiologists and others just don't get it. I want to come back to just quickly something about that later, but I saw another question back here.
I just wanted to make a comment as far as the DSM-4 diagnostic manual, Hightone. you know, a lot of the, because it was developed for the white, Western population, a lot of it does not apply to Russians, you know, and there are a lot of tests that people would take, the personality tests that are U.S. developed. If you give it to a Russian, they would come out completely whacked. But that is not because they're whacked. It's because the test is developed for a totally different cultural understanding of these disorders and issues. So, you know, so I mean, if you were to, you know, if you were to translate, I mean, there's one very good example in the DSM, you know, have you ever felt blue? You know, if you ever ask a Russian,
blue is another name.
So it's a lot of, I mean, a lot of things you can't just kind of take in and transplant it. What an IAAA categorizations are.
My problem is that when you look at the 700 mils, that's all hazardous or harmful drinking right there in and of itself. So to sort of compare, you know, and that only has a hazard ratio of 3, and that's hazardous. You're saying that something even greater than that is hazardous.
You're looking in the overdrive.
But I mean, but the title of the session is about mortality.
Yeah.
Right?
And let's go back to Dr. Friedman.
Well, actually, let me say one quick thing about something that you mentioned, is that this being normal, right, to drink not only some ongoing, but these what we're calling non-beverage alcohols. One of the studies that came out of this, Martin McKee and some folks went around, and so they found out what non-beverage alcohols are you drinking, and people often know them by name in terms of like the cologne. So they went out and got these and got samples of them and did gas chromatography on them and looked at the level of toxins in some and the level of ethanol in some. Ethanol was in some of these at or above 90%, for example. But one of the things that's interesting about this, one of the many, is that some of these, especially the colognes, are being sold on the shelves in these big, like, gallon jugs, right? You can go, well, they're passing laws against this now recently, and they're trying to remove these. But even if you are going to use it to perfume yourself, you're not going to use a gallon jug with a big lip on it like this, right? Maybe I have some friends that might use that much, but when they go out on the weekend. But you're not going to. Everyone knows that these are being produced for that market of consumption. So anyway, there are lots of fascinating things in there. Having said all that about alcohol, let's get away from alcohol for a minute. And talk about socioeconomic differentials. this particular study is coming out in the European Journal of Public Health. These are all using the same data that I talked about earlier. It's educational and marital status differentials. Education is going to be a proxy for socioeconomic status, for some specific period reasons here and Russian reasons. I mean, period as an age period cohort effects. But I'm going to focus just on socioeconomic status here. So here's where I'm going to read just a little bit because, as I said earlier, it's been I've been spending too much time on administrative things. So just bear with me here. So despite the importance of hazardous drinking, causes of death not directly due to alcohol account for still a large percentage of all deaths of working-age Russian males. It's therefore important that we argue to understand better the risk factors that are associated with negative health outcomes beyond those attributable to alcohol. Alcohol is important. It's very important, we just saw, but it's not everything. Furthermore, while a true mortality crisis that began in the 1990s did occur as a result of multiple causes, including alcohol, for those familiar with this, there's been a more fundamental and gradual decline in Russian health that has been progressing since the 1960s. And neither those chronic long-term events nor the acute effects of the most recent mortality crisis can be attributed solely to alcohol. Some recent health research on Russia that Vladimir has done and Shkolnikov has done and some others suggests that there are similarities with Russia and other developed nations in terms of inequalities in health outcomes. Mortality outcomes specifically. So we think that examining the impact of socioeconomic status is a logical starting point, and we're kind of using this as a base and then going to look at some other non-alcohol issues perhaps. It's also important to point out here, as most people know, that inequality, economic inequality, has increased tremendously in Russia, as has levels of poverty. Another aspect a little bit different is that newly available mortality data suggests that the implementation of some alcohol policies in recent years might actually be having some positive effect, and so it might be either as a result of policy or the people that are going to drink themselves to death drink themselves to death, and so you have a smaller proportion of people who, or you have a proportion of people who've already done that and they're no longer in your sample of sorts, I guess. So the impact of alcohol on mortality may diminish over time. This is Russia, and none of these things are going to happen quickly. But if so, we need to take a look at some other things that are potentially influencing these outcomes as well. So just quickly, the measurement of socioeconomic status here is education. There are some advantages to doing this, especially with Russia. Some are Russia-specific. Some are issues of method because you have bidirectional relationships. If you ask about current employment, for example, and you're looking at, and you have things like alcohol that is involved, you have these bidirectional relationships that employment is affected by these other things that you say are independent variables, or even the dependent variable, in terms of health outcomes, not mortality, obviously. You don't show up at work if you're dead, but you don't show up at work if you're very sick, this issue of labor and production that we talked about earlier. So all the same data are the same that I talked about. We control for age, we control for smoking, problem drinking, and marital status. And we disaggregated by alcohol-related and non-alcohol-related causes of death. And I can just give you the main, if you can't see this in the back, I can just tell you a little bit about some of the main things here. This is all causes here. And the reference category are those with a completed higher education. And the other categories are an incomplete higher education, specialized secondary education. This is one of those kind of relative to the U.S. This is kind of one of those, Russian peculiarities, although this is kind of similar to vocational training here beyond high school. A complete secondary education, professional school education, which again is different than what we think of as professional school, and incomplete secondary. And what we find is controlling for all these other factors, smoking, the hazardous alcohol consumption, these sorts of things, those with a specialized secondary or complete secondary, or incomplete, or those with a specialized secondary or complete secondary, that is high school education, were about 1.5 times or 50% more likely to die relative to those with a higher education, completed higher education. Those with professional school or an incomplete secondary education were about 2 to 2.5 times as likely to die relative to those with a complete higher education. And if you look, or I can point this out over here, what you see is that pretty much all of these effects are coming from the effect on non-alcohol-related causes of death. And when I say alcohol or non-alcohol, when we talk about alcohol-related, we're talking about those specifically directly related to alcohol, so liver poisoning, alcoholic liver cirrhosis, alcoholic poisoning, alcoholic cardiomyopathy, and mental and behavioral disorders related to alcohol that are the four direct causes. So there's really no effect of socioeconomic status on alcohol-related causes of death once you've controlled for alcohol consumption. There's only one of these five odds ratios that are significant, and being a kind of a quantitative person, I wouldn't make much out of that. If you only have one out of five, that's significant, especially when the one that's even lower than that is non-significant. On the other hand, I'm sorry, yeah, sure, sure, it's okay.
About the numbers for the non-alcohol-related causes.
Yeah.
Did you calculate the effect of the alcohol consumption for these diseases in terms of too many thoughts?
Yeah.
Did you account for alcohol prevalence in developing of these diseases? It wouldn't be directly cirrhosis or cardio. But if you are drinking too much, your high blood pressure goes up. Non-communicable diseases.
We did not. We have
this
that.
Is completely unrelated.
These are completely unrelated. Yeah. When we say alcohol-related here, there are only those four main causes that are due directly.
Mm-hmm.
These are complete. So, for example, I look at homicide and suicide. You know, those are external causes that may be associated with alcohol as well, but we don't include those in here. And so that, you know, that might make the estimate conservative. That's an interesting point, because in the last study, not for all the cases and controls in the study, but in the homeless study, which we'll get to in a couple of minutes, I actually come back and use some of those data to show even those that didn't die directly from alcohol, they still have, we can see, what, for example, how many of those had alcoholic cardiomyopathy, that sort of thing. So we didn't control for that here, but I will talk a little bit about that. So just quickly, what you see is that the magnitude of these effects are almost the exact same as overall. So it's really showing that the effects of socioeconomic status are coming from these non-alcohol related causes. Excuse me. So socioeconomic status matters here. It's important to point out, as I said earlier, that wealth and income inequality have increased substantially in Russia following the collapse of the Soviet Union. Thus, again, we think these socioeconomic differentials in health outcomes may become even more important if the current and future public health responses potentially, hopefully, reduce the role of alcohol in mortality. And one of the things here that is good to think about is Rose's idea, Jeffrey Rose's idea, for any epidemiologists or public health folks that are in here be familiar with this, of sick populations and sick people and sick populations. Right, so it may be, this is from an article that was published in 1984, 1985 in the International Journal of Epidemiology, but many people have discussed this issue as well, others have, is that, yeah, you may have a very high-risk group that have these, you know, mortality odds ratios of 3 or 9 or, you know, a really high-risk group of over 20 or over 20. But that's a relatively smaller chunk of the population. On the other hand, a much broader chunk of the population are exposed to these lower risk but still nevertheless significantly important outcomes. So you have the high odds ratios but a small number of people for things like really serious hazardous drinking. Whereas socioeconomic status, the odds ratios were much smaller relative to the alcohol and hazardous drinking. But they obviously affect a much broader exposure. You have a much broader exposure. Right? So we think that this may be something that's worthwhile to take a look at because of that.
Before you get onto the homeless stuff, in Russia, is education the same thing as socioeconomic status?
All right. Here are the reasons why we use this. One I mentioned because of the bidirectionality issues, where health, where your outcome, health, not mortality, but health, can and does, especially in Russia, when we look at these serious health problems, have an impact on the indicator, right? So then, when you talk about your regression assumptions, you know you have. You're violating some of those regression assumptions. And another thing here is that it's good you asked this because we did look at other indicators, not income, for example. Income is difficult to get, especially at this time in Russia where a lot of people are working different jobs. You have undeclared income. You know, they're selling things. You're bartering things, whatever the case may be. But I can say we did look at other indicators. We looked at different types of things that people possessed in their home. Did they have a car? Did they have a refrigerator or a microwave or something, these different things in their home, these goods? And in the odds ratios, the estimates varied a little bit, but the inferences were all the same. I think if one is looking solely at a point estimate in terms of, let's say, do these educational levels, are they a great measure of socioeconomic status? I don't think that they would be a great measure. I don't think you have something that's systematic, however, that you could really get at that would be a lot better. And what we do see is that they have the expected effects, theoretically, and that's pretty much the best one can go on in some of these cases, and have these other alternative measures besides the particular one that I talked about. But that's a good point. And as we mentioned in the paper, we estimated these other models with these alternative indicators and got the same results, and the same inferences anyway, I should say. Okay, so let's talk about the last study here. This came out about a year and a half ago. Did this with Yevgeny Andreev, who was at Goskomstat earlier. He's a demographer, but is now also at the Max Planck Institute, Vladimir Shkolnikov, and Olga Antonova. So I'll just go through this quickly. As you know, following the collapse of the Soviet Union, but before another serious financial crisis in 1998, we had this issue of decreased production, right, all sorts of difficulties, increased poverty, inequality, repeated economic and political crises. It had all sorts of bad outcomes, but we're talking about mortality, as was pointed out earlier, and so we had this mortality crisis that was one of those outcomes. Post-1998, or at least following that financial collapse, there's been pretty healthy annual growth in GDP until very recently, right, in Russia since that period. All these good things relative to the 1990s occur. They paid off their arrears. They had budget surpluses a few years. You had increases in public sector salaries, pensions, spending on these social programs, the national projects that didn't quite get off the ground, most of them, but started anyway in 2005. So, but the argument should be, is there a trickle-down of this? If health, including mortality, worsened, when we had these worsening political and economic crises, and we're saying were some cause of that health and mortality problems, then as things got better in terms of the political stability, whatever you think of it, it's stable relative to the 1990s, and the economic situation in general getting better, then we should expect a reflex point, right? That things should, if things got worse when they were bad, they should get better when they're getting health outcomes should get better when the political crises and economic crises subside. Generally, we see this is not really the case. This is that figure that I showed you earlier carried out a few more years, several more years actually. We see that the dip for males in life expectancy that occurred after 1998, or I guess I should say life expectancy hasn't recovered to 1998 levels for males. So while things were getting better in the country, as far as mortality, life expectancy goes, they were not showing any improvement. And if we actually carried this out until at least 2008, I have the data, the number's pretty much the same. It's right around 60, actually, like 59 point something. So this is the same even at least until a couple of years ago. So this shows us that overall things aren't getting much better in terms of mortality outcomes. But one of the things that happened was really pretty peculiar when they first started this collecting data on this. And so in late 2003, data collection started in October 2003. Late 2003, early 2004, they started, once enough information started to come in on the autopsies and all the information about these folks, about the decedents, they realized that almost 15%, 13%, I think was the proportion, 13% of the decedents were unidentified, completely unidentified. They had no, could not figure out from MVD, the police, all right, people that might have been neighbors. What we're going to argue is they don't have neighbors because they're homeless. 13% of these males, decedent males, were completely unidentified. I didn't know what to expect in terms of a number because when Vladimir came and asked me to work with him on this, given some of my interests, and I saw what the numbers were, well, it's extremely high, but I didn't really, you know, I don't do work in this, that particular area, so I don't know what would be a normal percentage. And so just quickly, I know some folks that work in New York City in the health department, and I asked them, and they have, in New York City, where you have a relatively high homeless population, it's much, much smaller than 1% of decedents are unidentified.
Excuse me, what's the sample here again? 13% of the mortality in what?
It, of that 25 to 54-year-old males. It's the same. It comes from the same study.
What?
No, this is in Ijevsk.
Just in Ijevsk.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. So we're arguing, and we're pretty sure that most of these folks are homeless, especially given the meaning of unidentified status in Russia and given the sample, which is good you asked about that, because these are not kind of much, much older people who, you know, maybe they outlive their spouse and they don't have any other family and they don't really, you know, they've been confined to their apartment the last several years of their life and no one really knows who they are. This is not what we're talking about. We're talking about 25 to 54-year-old working-age males. So also these are people obviously without passports, at least when they were brought in, and we know what that means, that... you know, passports are required for work, for a lot of financial transactions, you know, just to buy train tickets or something like that. Oftentimes, well, at least officially buying them if you're not bribing a conductor to get on or something like this, right? But the possession of a passport is important. And I say that, I guess, because I'm used to talking to non-Russianists and explaining this. But basically... this is another aspect of why we think these folks are homeless. And place of death and cause of death lead us to that conclusion as well. This is place of death by identified status. So these are all the unidentified folks here. There are 282 over the entire 2 years. And these are folks that are completely identified here. So what we see is only about 14% of these people died in or were found in a residence, relative to over half of those that were identified. Over a quarter of them died in a stairwell, cellar, attic, or courtyard of a residence. Now, this is not of a house or an apartment when we talk about cellar or attic, right? We're talking about apartment buildings. So this is where people go to, you know, get in out of the elements, to stay away from the cold, to get away from people that are harassing the homeless, that sort of thing. About a quarter of them were found somewhere outside on the street. I never really know what that means because usually it's like Naulitsa, so what is that? Is it outside or is it on the street, that sort of thing? Relative to 7% of the identified folks, 10% almost were found in a forest or other unsettled area. And then it's a small, relatively small percentage, but compared to completely identified folks, were essentially 0%. About 5% were found near a heating pipeline connector. So we can see that by place of death and not having the passport, we're getting closer and closer to showing, providing evidence that these are mostly homeless people. By cause of death also is interesting to take a look at. First of all, just look at the left column here. This is just the percent of all these homeless deaths by each of these causes. Exposure to natural coal, 20%. One out of every five of these, what we're now calling homeless deaths, were due to exposure to natural coal. One in 10 were due to acute respiratory infections. So again, these are things to which the homeless are especially vulnerable. And if you take a look at all those four causes, about 20%, if you add them all up together, about 20% of deaths were due to alcohol consumption. To alcohol consumption. Then over here, what you have are odds ratios. And we're comparing these, by the way, to the decedent, the identified decedents. So what that means is these are very, very conservative estimates in terms of the odds ratios because you're comparing them to people that have died, men who have died prematurely, so are themselves at risk of these very same causes, right? But still, you see that alcoholic cardiomyopathy, they're about 2.5 times more likely to die. These homeless men were, and they were about 2 times more likely to die of alcoholic liver disease. They're also, more likely to die of exposure to natural coal, about 8 times, twice for acute respiratory. Homicides and homicides are significantly more likely, about twice. I would almost guarantee that suicides are as well. This is not significant, but this category, if someone has questions about that later, I can talk a little bit about what's going on here, but these are violent but cause undetermined. So they will, by definition, fall into homicide or suicide. And one of the things that we're seeing, kind of ironically enough, as a little bit of an aside to what I mentioned earlier, is that I think that we're seeing some degradation in the vital statistics data in the post-Soviet era relative to the Soviet era, which is ironic because that's not what people normally think of as happening, right? But what folks are finding out is that people like me come along and use the mortality data to talk about homicide and talk about suicide, then all of a sudden the local and national folks realize that these are alternative measures that people can get. And so they're still being classified as violent. Well, actually, a lot of them aren't. You see a lot more falls from high places these days than you used to, and causes of death like that, especially in some of the larger cities. And they may get put into this violent death cause undetermined category. But anyway, that's a little bit of an aside. So you see what they're dying from, and relative to even other folks that are dying prematurely, they're at more risk for some of these. And here's that figure that I mentioned earlier. There's a role of alcohol in deaths of unidentified men, of the same folks we talked about earlier. And this is regardless of what they died from. So the first is the 20% or so that died directly from alcohol. But regardless, no matter what it is that these homeless men died from, over one-third of them had had a concentration of alcohol in their system of 0.10 or more in blood or urine. And over 60% of them had alcoholic cardiomyopathy or alcoholic liver disease, regardless, we can get that from the autopsies, regardless of what it is that they died from. So not only we're talking, we're saying that these are homeless folks, and also that they are, and then looking at what it is that they're dying from and the role that alcohol played there as well. And this kind of makes the point that I was saying earlier, that things are getting better. These are the percent of all deaths among men 25 to 54 that were unidentified. On the left is the Udmurt Republic, and this specifically is Ijevsk. And on the right is Russia. We only have data from 2000 on that. But what we see is that when things were getting better economically and more stable politically, the proportion of all deaths that were unidentified, so the homeless population, is increasing during this period. By the way, there were a couple, and Ijevsk, again, was not an outlier when it came to that 13%. We looked at several other cities. Somewhere around 10, 11, 12% was pretty common. There was one city where it was 18%, and I forget what city that was. It was 18%, so basically one in five of the deceased males in that age group were homeless, or at least unidentified. So there's widespread political and economic crises in the 1990s, along with the disappearance of the social safety net right when you need it most. The result was the mortality crisis since 1998. We've had these improved economic conditions, greater political stability. Yet, first of all, remember the first figure that I showed you in this study with this specific paper was premature mortality in general, or actually, excuse me, it was life expectancy, right? So overall mortality remains high, life expectancy remains low, and homelessness is increasing. So there's been very little attention, at least academically, paid to homelessness in Russia. Our indirect measure, these unidentified deaths, suggests that it's growing. The vulnerability of this particular group is evident in the leading causes of death, exposure to natural cold, acute respiratory infections, violence. These are all preventable causes of death. And then the role that alcohol plays. If you add up all those four categories, it rivals exposure to cold as leading cause of death. Obviously, as was mentioned, it plays an indirect role in other sorts of things. It plays an indirect role in exposure to cold anyway, and also in violence and in other types of causes of mortality also. It is itself a risk factor for social isolation and homelessness in the first place, and it's not just that they're drinking alcohol, right? It's what they're drinking and how they're drinking it. The pattern in general is one of binge drinking. Not that Zapoy we talked about earlier. That's why I say we have to be careful when we talk about, use the word binge. Usually, since NIAAA was mentioned earlier, five drinks for men, four for women in one setting, or usually three on a bottle, right, and then three on another bottle and go from there. So the pattern of drinking matters, but also what they're drinking. Vodka, generally, distilled spirits, but some aguan and the circuits. So, in conclusion, from that first study, we found that hazardous drinking plays a major role in premature mortality in the country, over 40% in this sample. And there's no reason to believe that this sample is unique terribly to the rest of the nation. There are differential effects of the transition on mortality among different groups. In this case, we looked at lower socioeconomic status and found that they were more likely to die prematurely, those males were. And then the not-so-hidden crisis of homelessness, that generally, and with homelessness, the mortality indicators are not improving at the same pace as the economy was throughout much of the first decade of the century, and that direct alcohol-related mortality is a leading cause of death among this group, and we think that this highlights a serious yet neglected public health issue that demands much further research and policy attention in that area. And I'll skip over the last stuff. Those are things that are upcoming or things that we're doing now. I'll be happy to answer more questions. Yeah. Well, it's depressing, and then also I usually do work on homicide and suicide, right? And so people say, oh, you're a very morbid person, look at very unpleasant things. I hopefully I'm not too morbid personally, but these are serious issues, right? So, yeah, sure.
Sure, sure.
So that you know, if you got a handle on who is actually alcohol dependent and separated them out as opposed to individuals who are just risky drinkers.
Right.
And I think that might give you a clue as to whether, you know, what role alcohol plays in the context of the SES.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah.
And the second one is that one of the most striking data I've ever seen is some doctors in the Rose in Petersburg. And they do a lot of health services for street kids there. And their data shows that any street kid who takes any alcohol or any drug is 100% HIV positive. And so one of the things I would encourage you to do, looking at causes of death, would be looking at HIV/AIDS in these populations, mm-hmm. because that's going to introduce a lot of treatment.
Yeah, you're right.
As well. So that, and it is a, you know, the data in Russia are just striking apart to drug and alcohol and HIV infectivity.
Yeah.
So that's one place you may want to take this.
Yeah, that's great. You're right. We were hoping to continue. I came in on this late. I've been working with these folks for quite a while, but they brought me in. I got the easy part. They collected all these amazing data, and then I just get to come along and take a look at them and do some analyses on some things. But the hope was to obviously to follow up on this study in Ijevsk. It's going to be difficult to follow up anywhere, given, as I said, that these are political, right? This is scientific analyses and scientific data, but they have political ramifications. And so, as I said, our folks on the ground have been harassed repeatedly by the FSB, and so it's likely that we're not going to continue the study in Ijevsk, but it is hopeful that there may be, we have a couple other spots where a follow-up study may be done, and this issue of HIV and injecting drug use, among others, has come up as being part of that study. So I think you're exactly right in that regard.
Quinn?
Yes, sir.
Actually, I'd like to follow up a little bit on the question of the what I imply is the shooting the messenger syndrome.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little more about what the reaction was, where the reaction was? Because you basically said your researcher had a really tell because this information is so unpopular.
I don't know if I can say much more just because of information. I haven't been directly involved, and I'm essentially kind of a consultant, an unpaid one at this stage. It's at both. It's at the national level. There were some considerable issues all the way to the top, even though when statements were being made by the president annually, you could look at some of Shkolnikov's work and seeing that this was coming pretty much directly from the demographic aspects were coming directly from what he and his colleagues were talking about. And at the federal level, in terms of the alcohol stuff, there were some serious responses to them as well. There have been some difficulties in different types of things. So, for example, the heart assays, there were and other types of tissue assays, where initially it was fine. They were taking these out of the country to do analyses on them. And then all of a sudden, once these issues start to, you know, hit in big journals, so the Dave Leon et al. Study was in The Lancet and it gets picked up by, you know, the media, they all of a sudden stopped allowing them to take the tissues out of the country. And this had been approved, of course, by, you know, all IRB boards and everything, including there in Russia or the equivalent or whatnot. At the local level, the harassment of the researchers has been at the local level, Ijevsk specifically. So, yeah.
But I couldn't help but notice the coincidence of the timing of the sample study.
So obviously, I mean, you know, we may have got lucky in one sense. So some people may want to take credit for that, but obviously, alcohol problems in Russia are not new, right? And there were a suite of policies that Putin put in at different times, but then the national project obviously was you know, at that in 2005, along with some other things. And then that
the Vietnam. Figures about surrogate alcoholics. I don't think I've ever seen numbers that shocking.
Yeah. And there were, by the way, I mean, there were some isolated incidents too of where people got bad batches. Essentially, you probably remember this, or maybe read it in the paper or whatever. Bad batches of some Agwan, and then they would go. There was a specific policy response to those, kind of just like we have anywhere else, right? If something hits the media, and it's going on. It's always happened, but it hits the media, and then there's some legal
during
response.
During Gorbachev times, when it was the dry law,
yeah.
emergency care facility was piled to the brim with the dying wedding guests or anybody, because we didn't have any alcohol available readily.
Yeah.
That's why they would go to the hooch makers.
Right.
To provide that. Yeah, I know that mid to late ages.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there.
Did you have any? Access to these numbers by any chance during the time when Gorbachev went south and cut down all the vineyards?
A couple of things happened there that are interesting and that relate to what we've talked about. One is that you have a decrease in mortality, in alcohol-related mortality overall, because you have probably lower levels of population-level drinking. But nevertheless, those that you know are hardcore drinkers, you know, they're getting it, right? So they're going to get it elsewhere, and if they can't buy it in the stores or you know production dropped and distribution dropped, et cetera. So what they're going to get is unregulated alcohol, and so that kind of relatively smaller but very very high risk group, right, are the ones that were showing up. I have some data that unfortunately I'm probably not going to be able to use because of this issue of putting the local folks at risk. But one of the things I wanted to do is do a time series analysis, interrupted time series analysis of the Gorbachev campaign. And I looked for years to try to get these data. And then finally working closely with the folks in Izhevsk, I basically, you know, none of this was digitized, right? So mm-hmm. I paid someone to sit on their butt in a back room with a file cabinet and going through the original death certificates from Izhevsk to from this period, all of the 1980s by month, and categorizing them, if they were homicides or suicides, looking at those, and then looking at blood and alcohol or alcohol in the blood or urine, and I have those and I've played around with them, but I'm not going to be able to use them to publish on anything. Another thing, though, this is important too, is that these, maybe people know this here since Russianists or Eastern Europeanists, but even though there might have been some initial overall public health effects, positive public health effects, right, some people have argued, I think it's an empirical question, I don't know what the answer to it is, but some people have argued that because of these distribution networks, because of all the increase in some Agwan production, and not just rights, some people sitting at home making it in their bathtub, the bathtub gin, but real large level distribution, people making money on this, that were created as a result of the anti-alcohol campaign, that in the long run that has had a detrimental effect on health and has contributed somewhat to the increases in mortality following the collapse of the Soviet Union. So those early returns, positive returns, might have just been putting things off a little bit. So it's part of the argument.
Yeah. May I ask you just a completely different question?
Yeah, sure.
On presidential summit in 2008, and mm-hmm. While you were talking about all the difficulties you see in getting to certain data, the presidential summit between Medvedev and Obama in 2008, July, they came to the agreement that certain things have to be happening in Russian healthcare to improve Russian population health. And my organization is working on a certain proposal how to address our point of interest, which is non-communicable diseases, and we chose to concentrate on cardiovascular diseases. And maybe with your research, you can, get to the place of understanding and more cooperation if you maybe rely on those national policies, which says, well, the non-direct effect of alcohol on cardiovascular is such and such. If we want to improve cardiovascular, kind of go backtracking, because if President makes negative statements about the nature of your job, you can go back to, 2008 summit, for example.
Sure, that's
but
great.
Weren't we agreeing on developing partnerships, which are not going to be based, that's what we agreed upon, on the aid-like relationship, but it will be a truly partnership. American part will be investing 50% of the effort and financing, and Russian part will be investing 50% and financing. And if we want to improve cardiovascular health of the population, which is number one cause of mortality, your studies and your data comes into such a huge play because it affects the breadwinners.
That's great.
Have you ever thought about I
am not as close. I'm familiar with that, yes. But I am not as close in on... I'm still kind of an outsider or a consultant on the data part and analyzing. And so Dave Leon and Martin McKee and Shkolnikov have been the PIs, and especially Dave Leon, who's a Brit. He's an epidemiologist at University of London, and Martin McKee is as well. So maybe I should just say, well, you should bring on this American to be a PI, and then we can then bring these policies into play, perhaps, right? But it's a great point. I'm familiar with that, but I don't know how they have – I don't know all the things that they've tried to do, because I'm kind of at a remove from at a far remove from those main issues of interaction. But it's a great point perhaps to refer to.
You've seen cardiovascular disease increase globally, and that's because of the increase in Western lifestyle. I mean, they've got McDonald's, they've got Burger King, they've got Kentucky Fried Chicken.
We don't like McDonald's.
But they're playing video games, and they're not exercising, and
they're driving cars more than they used to.
Right, and they're drinking alcohol, and it's a recipe for cardiovascular disease.
True.
So it's just a piece of...
We are trying to attack cardiovascular disease issue. That comes into play.
It's one component,
among
right.
other things. It's just because we're trying to address cardiovascular, that could be a really good shield for your work, because this data affects so much, the indirect cause for my cause.
That would be great.
So we should
talk to you.
From the government standpoint, which you mentioned, and I'm more via by the way, from the government standpoint, Thomas and I are on a working group that is actually trying to coordinate these activities that you're mentioning, the health working group. And it's not as easy as a scientist saying, I'm interested in studying topic A, and I have a collaborator that is also interested in the same thing. These are at a higher level, and there's a lot of...
Like I said, science, science and advocacy are two different things, right?
Yes.
Government.
But
we couldn't go far enough without you.
Oh, yeah. It's been fascinating to me. I admit to being a little naive, because, unlike most sociologists, perhaps, and especially criminologists, I take a very strong scientific approach to my work, and so I just, these are data. They've been, the measures are what they are. They've been collected it's a great design that they were able to do, very strong design, case control with this level. And so let's go at it. Let's see what the results are. And you find out what the results are, and you put it in a scientific journal. That obviously has political ramifications that I admit to being naive about. So,
since you do criminology, I would be very interested in and would suggest, taking a look at what the role registries have in individuals in Russia accessing healthcare services. And I think that's a big issue, because if you're going to create plans or to reduce alcohol or to address alcohol, and you have a system where in the criminal justice system registers alcoholics, and you know, which requires them to be 3 years absence to come off the registry, then and that has a great impact on all of their lifestyle issues. You know, what role that does play in their decision to become homeless or and to live outside the system because they have an alcohol problem and they're drinking.
Oh, that's a great point, yeah.
And so that, do they really want to get involved with the registry and all that? And because when you get down to the scenario I am, which is getting the health services in there, you know, everything's all about access. You know, whether you drink, it's about whether you got access to alcohol. But if you need health services and you don't have access to them because of barriers, it's not going to work either.
You're absolutely right.
And my question is, have you looked at the national concept for alcohol that was recently introduced?
Yeah, yes, but it's just,
Have any way to actually utilize that as one of the ways to push your agenda for women's issues?
Well,
Yeah,
well, not really, and it's purely due to reasons that have nothing to do with research or this issue or whatever. I am, alas, pretty far removed from my science right now and the research because of my administrative roles. But that's going to end in a year.
I'm wondering if some of your colleagues, in particular Martin McKee,
right.
would be interested in actually utilizing that new...
Oh, those folks, yeah.
To move the agenda forward, because it's really, it's a window.
Yeah, it is. And that's not dissimilar to... the approach of using, trying to find a window to push this forward, yeah. And so I know Dave and those folks are doing what they can. And looking at different opportunities like that, yeah. But I'm kind of far removed from that personally right now. Although I hope it happens because it'll...
Please come back.
It'll trust me, you have no idea how much I want to. This is short-term, short-term. But hopefully about the time that I'm coming back will be the time that they'll start collecting data so I can come back with that.
All right.
That's a great. Those are both great points, yeah.
I know Wayne's got a question, but I'm going to direct him to ask it individually because we promise people that we'll finish up properly at noon. So I want to thank William again for his emphasis.